All that night they kept the column of refugees moving down the track, and in the early light of dawn they shepherded the last onto the bank of the Kitangula River. Tinat was waiting for them at the gates of the boatyard stockade and came quickly to meet Taita. "I am glad to see you safe, Magus, but I am sorry to have missed the fighting. I have reports that it was hot and heavy. What news of the Jarian pursuit?"
"The bridge over the gorge is down, but that will not hold them for long. Sidudu says there is an easier road down the escarpment 40 leagues further to the south. We can be sure that Soklosh knows about it, and that he will take his men that way. He will be moving a great deal faster than we were able to. We can expect him to join us again soon.
The southern road is the main entry port into Jari. Of course, Soklosh must know of it. I have left pickets upon the road to watch for him and to warn us of his approach," Taita told him. "We must get these people onto the boats at once."
First they loaded the horses, then the remaining refugees. Before the last were aboard, the pickets galloped into the boatyards. "The Jarians' leading cohorts will be upon us within the hour." Merrin and his men chivied the last group of refugees down the jetty and into the boats. As soon as each vessel was filled, the rowers pulled out into the main stream of the river and turned the bows down the current. Fenn and Sidudu carried Hilto's litter onto the last boat in the flotilla. 20 remained empty on the slipways, so Taita remained ashore with a few men to see to their destruction. They threw lighted torches into them, and when the timbers were blazing fiercely, they pushed them into the river, where they burned swiftly to the waterline. The lookouts on the walls of the stockade that surrounded the boatyard sounded the alarm on kudu horn trumpets.
"The enemy is in sight!"
There was a final scramble for the boats. Taita and Merrin jumped onto the deck where the two girls were waiting anxiously for them. Merrin took the helm, and the rowers pulled away from the dock. They were still within bowshot of the bank when the leading squadron of the Jarian vanguard galloped into the boatyard. They dismounted and crowded the bank to loose volleys of arrows, some of which pegged into the deck, but nobody was hit. Merrin swung the bows to catch the current of the wide Kitangula, which was in spate, and bore them away, sweeping them round the first bend. He leant on the long steering oar as they gazed back at the high cliffs of the Jarian Massif. Perhaps they should have been ecstatic as they took their leave of the Kingdom of Eos, but rather they were silent and sober. Taita and Fenn stood apart from the others. Fenn broke the silence at last. She spoke low for Taita's ears alone.
"So we have failed in our quest. We have escaped. But the witch survives, and the Nile flows no longer. The game is not yet played out. The pieces are still on the board," Taita told her.
"I do not take your meaning, my lord. We are flying from Jari, deserting the battlefield and leaving the witch alive. You have nothing to take back to Egypt and Pharaoh but these miserable refugitives and our own poor selves. Egypt is still doomed."
"Nay, that is not all I take back with me. I have all the wisdom and astral power of Eos.
How will that profit you or Pharaoh if Egypt dies of drought?"
"Perhaps I will be able to use the witch's memories to unravel her mysteries and designs."
"Do you already hold the key to her magic?" she asked hopefully, watching his face.
"This I do not know. I have taken from her a mountain and an ocean of knowledge and experience. My inner mind and consciousness are awash with it. There is so much that, like a dog with too many bones, I have had to bury most of it. Perhaps some is so deeply buried that I will never retrieve it. At best it will take time and effort to assimilate it all. I will need your assistance. Our minds have become so attuned that only you can help me with this task."
"You do me the honour, Magus," she said simply.
The Jarian cohorts pursued them for several leagues downstream, riding hard along the track that followed the riverbank, until swamps and thick jungle forced them to abandon the chase. The flotilla raced along on the current, which was swollen with the rain that had fallen on the mountains of the moon, leaving the enemy far behind. Before nightfall that day, the leading vessels of the squadron reached the first of the rapids that had so impeded their voyage upriver so many months before.
Now the white water sent them hurtling down the chutes, the banks blurring past on each side. At the tail of the rapids, when they stormed ashore below the stockade walls of the small Jarian garrison, they discovered that the soldiers had fled as soon as they realized that the flotilla was hostile. The barracks was deserted, but the storerooms were well stocked with weapons, tools, and stores. They loaded the pick of the supplies onto the barges and pressed on eastwards. A mere 10 days after embarking, they sailed out through the mouth of the Kitangula into the vast blue expanses of the Lake Nalubala and turned northwards, following the shore round towards the hills of Tamafupa. By this time, the voyage had settled into a routine. Taita had claimed a corner of the deck just forward of the rowing benches for himself and Fenn. He had spread a matting sail over it for shade and privacy. They spent most of their days sitting close together on a sleeping mat, holding hands and gazing into each other's eyes while he whispered to her in the tenmas. It was the only language that was adequate to convey to her all the new information with which his mind brimmed. As Taita murmured to her, he became acutely aware of how her mind and her astral soul were expanding. She was giving back to him almost as much as she was taking, and the experience strengthened and enriched them. Also, far from exhausting them, their intense, unremitting mental activity enlivened them. Each evening the flotilla anchored before sunset, and most of those aboard went ashore for the night, leaving only an anchor watch aboard. Usually Taita and Fenn took advantage of the last hours of daylight to wander along the shore and the fringes of the forest, gathering roots, herbs, and wild fruit. When they had sufficient for their dinner and for any medicines they required, they returned to their shelter, which was set apart from the rest of the encampment. On some evenings they invited Merin and Sidudu to share the meal they had concocted, but often they kept their own company and continued with their studies far into the night. When at last they lay down on their sleeping mat and pulled the fur kaross over themselves, Taita took her in his arms. She cuddled against him, and without the least sign of self-consciousness, reached down and took him in an affectionate but unskilled grip. Often her last drowsy words before she fell asleep were not to Taita himself, but to the part of him that she held. "Oh, my sweet mannequin, I like playing with you, but you must lie down to sleep now, or you will keep us awake all night." Taita wanted her desperately. He longed for her with all his newfound manhood. But in many ways he was as innocent and untutored as she was. His only carnal experience had been the brutal warfare of the Cloud Gardens, in which he had been forced to use his body as a weapon of destruction, not as a vehicle of love. It had had not the remotest relationship to the bittersweet emotion he felt now, which grew more poignant each day. When she fondled him, he was consumed with an overpowering desire to express his love in the same intimate manner, but instinct warned him that although she stood at the very portals of womanhood, she was not yet ready to take the final step across the threshold. "We have a lifetime, perhaps many, ahead of us," he consoled himself, and determinedly composed himself to sleep.